Hello, I'm Peter Gilchrist.
And I'm Dr. Lindsay Middleton.
We are on a mission to investigate Scotland's food history, from the folklore of its ancient people to the traditions of our own grandparents.
We'll be talking to historians, producers, and Scotland's finest to try and uncover the chapters from our nation's food story.
And this season, we're taking a look at the people that revolutionised Scotland's cuisine.
We'll be diving back into the 19th century and talking to today's food champions.
It's time to investigate our great Scots. Good morning, Lindsay. How are you?
Good morning, Peter. I'm grand. How are you?
That was, you're far brighter than me. I am fine. I am fine. It has been an interesting weekend. I've just launched a new series called Getting Pissed with My Ancestors. My mum felt that I should have gone with Pished. She felt that was less offensive and more Scottish.
Pished, yeah.
Yeah, it probably is.
Have a sort of slight softness to it, but I think pissed has got, you know, you're doing this with purpose. You want people to
Yes. Yes. So today's episode is slightly different. We have no guests on, and we ourselves are not going to be doing the talking. We are going to be giving you a sneak peek into our keynote from the Scottish Food Heritage Symposium.
Yes. We hosted the symposium back in March of this year.
Yes.
And it was the second one that we've done. It was a brilliant day. We managed to sort of sell out the tickets and then some. And we had it at Macintosh at the Willow Tea Rooms as we were discussing the kind of legacy of Glasgow and Glasgow Tea Rooms and Kate Cranston, as we discussed in our episode last week with Oliver. It was brilliant. It was such a beautiful day. So we were discussing tea. We had talks from different academics. We heard from our keynote, as we'll introduce. And we were basically just sort of talking about the history of tea in Scotland. We also spoke to the Scran podcast. So there's extra listening.
We need to get Kelly the producer, and Rosalind, the editor for the Scotsman Food and Drink, and the host of the Scran podcast. I think we need to get them on to an episode because they've interviewed us a couple of times. And yeah, I want to put the screws to them, put them under the the microscope, the mic, I don't know. Yeah. But no, definitely. So, yes, with today, we're going to be giving you a bit of a sneak peek into our keynote from a writer, an author called Perilla Kinchin. Perilla is the authority on Catherine Cranston and Glasgow Tea Rooms. And after mine and Lindsay's chat in the last episode about the life of Kate, I was listening back to her keynote, and she really does this like excellent job of summarising like 100 years of tea room evolution. So Perilla, she wrote Taking Tea with Macintosh. She wrote a book called Miss Cranston. She wrote a book called Tea and Taste, a look at Glasgow's tea room history. Again, for those of you who were delighted by last week's episode, this episode is for you. If you thought last week's episode went too in detail, you might want to skip this episode this week, because we're about to get a thorough overview of Victorian Glasgow.
I found Perilla's keynote so fascinating. I think she's fascinating herself as a cultural and social historian. I remember when we initially had a chat with her, and it was Oliver at the Willow, and he sort of said that his dream was to have Perilla up to the Willow to do a talk. So one of the beautiful things about the symposium that we managed to do was actually make that happen. But when we'd initially spoken to Perilla, she sort of outlined how she came to Glasgow and its history. And I think her sister was also an academic, and she was based in Glasgow, and Perilla had happened to come up and just realised there was this massively sort of untapped history, unknown history of commerce and women's trade and art, and that was what sort of led her to the tea room. So I learned so much about Glasgow from this. I had no idea the extent to which Kate's legacy went, and also, you know, the many different factors that were coming into it. So yeah, it's a fascinating deep dive into the teacup, you might say, of Glasgow's history.
Here's Perilla Kinchin.
Well, thank you very much. I'm, of course, extremely honoured to have been asked here, and I love the way you're treating me as the grand old lady of the Glasgow team. But after the excellent, very focused talks we've had during the day, this will be a bit of a general gallop through what's quite a long history. So, Glasgow, in truth, is a very Tokyo for tea rooms. Nowhere can one have so much for so little. Nowhere are such places more popular and frequented. So wrote J.H. Muir, who was, in fact, three bright young men hiding beneath a pseudonym, in Glasgow in 1901, a little book introducing the city to the torrent of visitors coming to its second great international exhibition. They identified what was by then a distinct phenomenon produced by the entrepreneurial openness to opportunity that distinguished Glasgow at its height. The tea rooms became embedded into city life in a very particular way. Glaswegians loved them for their cheapness, their high standards, and their convenience. And this thriving, unstuffy business city was the same Glasgow that produced a distinctive local flowering of art and design in the later 19th century. And Miss Cranston's flair was to combine all this into something truly special. So the beginnings were shaped by the Cranstons, brother and sister, but it's the redoubtable Catherine, who's become well known again, eagerly taken up, of course, as a woman who can be written back into history and appreciated for her crucially important role in the career of Glasgow's now acknowledged architectural genius, Charles Rennie Mackintosh. She was in many ways inimitable, but she was imitated, and by countless others in Glasgow and beyond. Tea rooms multiplied in the last two decades of the 19th century, and then in the Edwardian years, slightly more slowly, and went on developing long after Miss Cranston withdrew from business, dominated in the 1920s and 30s by the super tea rooms of Glasgow's great family baking firms. They were only really finished off after the Second World War, along with so much of Glasgow's economy. So it's appropriate to today that the origins of the tea rooms lie squarely with tea. The Cranstons were brought up in what would now be called the hospitality business. Their parents ran a series of hotels in George Square, and they were related to Temperance Hotel royalty. Their father's cousin, Robert Cranston, who, with his very capable wife, Elizabeth, had founded the prominent Waverley Temperance Hotels in Edinburgh. Kate Cranston was 18 when her mother died, and she doubtless took over responsibilities in running the hotel, something which would stand her in good stead. But Stuart, a year older, had been attracted into the tea trade. He trained himself as an expert taster while working as an agent for Joseph Tetley, before setting up on his own account as a retailer in 1871. Which was coincidentally the same year that Glasgow grocery giants Cooper and Co. and Lipton's began business. Cranston was genuinely passionate, you could say obsessive, about his tea, and kept a kettle to hand to offer sample cups. And when he moved to slightly larger premises in Queen Street in 1875, he arranged some tables and announced a sample cup of 4 shilling Kai Sao with sugar and cream. That picks up something we were discussing earlier. Cream it is, not milk. For tuppence, bread and cakes extra. This then was the birth of the tea room. How delighted I was to discover when I started working on the tea room some 35 years ago that Glasgow invented them. nothing comes from nothing, of course, but it is a claim that Stuart stuck to. So it was 3 years later, in 1878, that Stuart's sister Kate opened the Crown Tea Rooms, named after the family hotel in the bottom of a temperance hotel on Argyle Street, which was well located for the businessmen she had identified as her chief market. From the start, she ran something closer to a restaurant, providing cheap, well-cooked breakfasts, lunches, and high teas, as well as coffees and afternoon tea, in a comfortable, homely environment. So in this way, she was really the originator of the archetypal Glasgow tea room. So the predominantly male clientele is clear in the announcement of her first expansion in 1886 to the ground floor of a commercial building in Ingram Street, again in Glasgow's business area. At this stage, apparently collaborating with her brother's business, which was supplying its mandarin tea. It's noticeable that she was trading as C. Cranston at this time, hiding her gender for business purposes. And this subterfuge also got her into directory listings above her brother and her cousins, which, of course, these listings by convention gave you first men, then married women, and finally spinsters. But also notable is the sort of generally artistic style of the ad. And this quality of taste was soon associated with Kate Cranston's business. The Bailey magazine, Glasgow's Punch, described a large, commodious room for gentlemen and a neat little apartment, I should almost say arbour, for ladies. The painting of the walls and ceilings is of the most artistic charm and is altogether in the style of the Flowery Land, i.e. Japan. I mean, there was a passion for everything Japanese at the time. The ad announces at the bottom the imminent opening of a smoking room, which was more accommodation for men taking their morning coffee and smoke. There was excitement in 1888, Glasgow's first attempt at a great exhibition approached. To prepare for visitors in the city, Miss Cranston, and she was now trading as Miss Cranston, her business entirely separate from her brother's, which was Cranston's, although confusion, understandably enough, has surfaced ever since. Miss Cranston turned to a promising young designer to refresh her first premises in Argyle Street. George Walton was developing an innovative but livable version of an arts and crafts style, which, along with the work of others, would become known loosely as the Glasgow style. Kate's commission gave the 20-year-old the courage to abandon his job in a bank and set up his own decorating company. Was the first example of her willingness to take a punt on largely untested young designers. The exhibition itself, intoxicating to Glaswegians with its fantastical buildings and fairy lights and gondolas on the Kelvin, gave a boost to the idea of tea drinking for pleasure. Perhaps at the Ceylon Tea House or in the Indian Tea Rooms, both of which reflected the growing popularity of tea from this part of empire. So this is a sketch by John Lavery of the Temperance Cafe at the exhibition's reconstructed Bishop's Palace, run by one Joseph Lyons, a catering contractor from down south. The waitresses, done up in Mary Queen of Scots outfits, were nicknamed Lyons' Widows. So Joe Lyons left Glasgow with some ideas and established his chain of tea rooms in London in 1893. The Glasgow School of Cookery's tea room in the women's art and industry section may have helped encourage the idea of running a tea room as a possibility for middle-class women needing to support themselves. Certainly, with Miss Cranston showing the way, this was something that took off in the next decade, and women had much to do with the distinctive quality of the tea rooms. Meanwhile, the hugely successful exhibition left Glasgow in an upbeat mood, and many tea rooms sprang up in the city afterwards, taking advantage of exhibition-trained waitresses. In 1889, Stuart Cranston opened a major suite of rooms, replete with every comfort which science and experience can suggest, on Buchanan Street, Glasgow's premier shopping street. Out of all sight, the biggest set of tea rooms, not only in Glasgow or in Scotland, but in Britain, or indeed anywhere, according to the Bailey. Giving him its menu no slot, the magazine commented on the tea room as one of the newer features of Glasgow life. Neither a public house nor a pastry cook's, it has a character of its own, and one which commends itself to the community generally. You can see from the hall-like space and the arrangement of tables and plush banquette that Stuart Cranston's preferred style was fairly conventional, and his catering did not go beyond baked goods. Whatever the entrepreneurial flair of the Cranstons, their businesses would not have taken root and been so quickly imitated if they did not perfectly meet the felt needs of the time. And these were essentially the separate needs of men and of women in a society strongly influenced by the temperance movement. Temperance coffee rooms and refreshment rooms were clear forerunners of the tea rooms in respectability. Both Cranstons were practical abstainers, but temperance was never an issue in the presentation of the tea rooms, which traded simply on the excellence of their offer. And thanks to the tasteful feminine quality developed by Miss Cranston and her followers, they shook off that suspicion of dourness which attached to the more evangelical temperance establishments. The primary demand identified by Miss Cranston, as we've seen, was from men. The businessman's morning break for coffee and smoke and gossip was held to be an important tool of wealth creation. With their men-only smoking rooms, the tea rooms met this need. And then, with Glasgow growing ever westwards, men couldn't get home for lunch as in the old days. This is when we're meant to see Langs, so I have to go back and find them. Yes, there we are, Langs at lunchtime. Because this need had already spawned another unique Glasgow institution, the Champion Luncheon Rooms of Langs, founded in the mid-19th century, which claimed invention of the self-service quick lunch bar. At midday, it was one of the sights of Glasgow, packed with businessmen, browsing on an array of delicious eatables, including a famously large variety of sandwiches, washed down with ale or whiskey or milk. There was an honour system of payment, that is, you ate ad lib, did some mental arithmetic, and paid. And this was something universally adopted by the tea rooms. You notice that they also stood and kept their hats on to support the impression they weren't really stopping for lunch. There had been other places for midday refreshment, chop houses, taverns, pie shops, restaurants, but they served alcohol. Men, under pressure from their women folk to moderate their drinking, or young clerks just counting their pennies, gladly sat down in a tea room for a cheap and well-cooked lunch. The needs of women were the crucial new element of demand, as Cranston saw, advertising to them as customers for his loose tea. After being housebound in earlier Victorian days, they were eager to get out and about more, and shopping became a key leisure activity with the growth from the 1880s of the new department stores. Tea rooms, most offering restrooms, were useful ports of call, especially for lunch and afternoon tea. Importantly, they were respectably accessible without a male escort, because even the smallest premises tried to provide the safe space of a dedicated ladies' room. So the 1890s, the decade of the new, saw a great leap forward in the city in many respects, and tea rooms multiplied. In 1895, the Evening News wrote, "A decade ago, the tea rooms of the city could be counted on one's fingers. Now their name is Legion." Like other papers, they were picking up on a noticeable social phenomenon of the time. Vegetarianism and women's bicycling also made frequent copy. You can see here a sample of tea room advertisements of the period, boasting different facilities. Kirkland's was obviously a tea dealer's, quite simple tea rooms on the pattern of Cranston's. Skinner's was a classy confectioner, which was popular with ladies. The Mikado, meanwhile, which catered for functions and appealed particularly to, it was described as a favourite resort of football clubs. That's because its proprietor was a retired footballer. But tea rooms were easy meeting places, serving as clubs for groups of clerks and perfect for committees. There'd always been women in catering businesses, generally invisible behind the names of male relatives, but Kate Cranston's panache clearly cut through, and there were several operating tea rooms under their own names, like Miss Loudon and Mrs. Schiller. Stuart Cranston, meanwhile, bought the whole of the Argyle Arcade and floated his company in 1896 as Cranston's Tea Rooms Limited, Stuart Cranston, founder and director. He opened a large suite of rooms on Renfield Street the following year and was a vigorous advertiser. Meanwhile, Miss Cranston went in for more imaginative ways of arresting attention. From 1892, she was, in fact, Mrs. Cochrane, having married at the age of 43 a prosperous barhead engineer 8 years her junior. What would have ended an independent career for most women simply enabled her to go much bigger. She followed her brother onto Buchanan Street and blazed forth as Miss Cranston, retaining in business the name, which encapsulated her reputation, that was crucial to her brand. This is the novel Hoarding that George Walton painted to hide work on a new building, 4 floors, with a kitchen in the basement, housing a suite of lunch and tea rooms, including a billiard room for the men. The revealed building was in fashionable historicist style. It was inside that there was something dazzlingly new. Miss Cranston had handed all the decor and furnishing, right down to the cutlery, to George Walton, except for some wall decoration on 3 floors, for which she tried out the new art weirdry, to use a journalist phrase, of Charles Rennie Mackintosh. And this establishment, which became her HQ, shot Miss Cranston's tea rooms to site of the city status when they opened in 1897. The English architect Edwin Lutyens captured this perfectly, writing home to his fiancée, that he was taken along to a Miss Somebody's, who is really a Mrs. Somebody else. It's all very elaborately simple on very new school high art lines. The result is gorgeous and a wee bit vulgar. She has nothing but green-handled knives, and all is curiously painted and coloured. Visiting again the next year, he went straight from the station to these queer, funny rooms and recorded his most excellent breakfast: tea, butter, jam, toasts, baps and buns, two sausages, two eggs, speak it not in Gath, all for one and a penny. So clean, most beautiful peonies on the breakfast table, and the china the same as ours. That's because Miss Cranston had kindly furnished him a set of her own brand willow pattern crockery on his previous visit. He then describes her as a dark, busy, fat wee body with black, sparky, humorous eyes, and ends, "So I am much amused and greatly entertained. The food, etc., at a third the cost and three times better than the ordinary hotel, and the surroundings full of space for fancy and amusement." So Lutyens puts his finger on the elements of Miss Cranston's success. Beyond the engaging avant-garde decor, which was covered in the Studio, Britain's leading art magazine, her offer was built on reliable quality and good value for money. All this provoked renewed coverage in the local press. Anyone would judge from the number of tea rooms sprouting everywhere that these, aesthetic or otherwise, must be profitable concerns, wrote St. Mungo magazine in October 1897. And the Bailey ran an article on the spread of the insidious tea room, mourning the death of the pint of bitter and a dressed steak lunch, and describing a new kind of roué, the clerk of artistic temperament, seduced by a potent mixture of tea, tobacco, talk, and pretty waitresses. Towards the end of the century, Kate turned to her original location at 114 Argyle Street, having acquired the lease for the whole hotel building, and set about another major expansion. You can judge the scale of the premises from this photo. The exterior was recast by an architect, and the entry to the original tea room was attractively redesigned by Walton. Facilities for men were important in this working part of town. They could nip through this archway to a tower at the back, which gave unimpeded access to the spacious smoking and billiard rooms on the upper floor, which was the first part of the building to be opened. The rest followed later in 1899. Inside, George Walton handled the decoration and fittings, including the leaded glass and stencil decoration at which he excelled. This choice Eros panel exemplifies Miss Cranston's readiness to pay for artistic embellishment of the rooms. And this time, Mackintosh exercised his ingenuity, his originality, on the furniture. His strong designs included the first of his famous high-backed chairs, which lent that quality of overstatement which was perfect for Miss Cranston. In modern parlance, she was on a roll, and with Glasgow's second great exhibition coming up in the new century, she turned in 1900 to expanding and refurbishing her Ingram Street premises in the advanced style with which she was now identified. This time, instead of working under Walton, who had left for London, Mackintosh had sole control. He was now collaborating with his fiancée, the artist Margaret MacDonald. They married in August 1900, and she clearly contributed to the exquisite atmosphere of the ladies' lunchroom here. The couple worked matching decorative gesso panels, one each to face each other across the room, a commission in the nature of a wedding present. From this point on, all Miss Cranston's major work came to Mackintosh. She was simply his best and most loyal patron over the next years, through thick and thin. Kate's idiosyncratic style of dress is telling. I mean, no one else dressed like this. Clearly, she knew what she liked, and she liked to be different. She evidently responded to Mackintosh's perfectionism, and they developed a relationship of trust. She gave him a pretty free hand, enormously important for his development, and seemed not to quibble at overrunning costs. Total control suited him. The tea room, unlike a domestic interior, would be kept just as he conceived it. He gave her that something extra, that over-the-top quality which made the tea room experience something exciting and special. Kate Cranston had come into her own as a leading Glasgow personality. Her name had become an adjective. J.H. Muir records Kate Cranstonish, used as a term for domestic novelties in buildings and decorations not otherwise easy to define. There was no question about her taking a prominent place among caterers at Glasgow's International Exhibition in 1901. It was almost certainly Mackintosh who designed her white tea house opposite a new footbridge over the Kelvin. In a last gesture, perhaps, Kate did ask George Walton to design the menu card. And it's interesting to see that she's now using Melrose's tea, not her brother's. This was something that you've been touched on this morning. There was consternation when the tea room, the tea house, as it was called, burned down in July. But a marquee was erected and it was quickly reconstructed. As I said at the outset, J.H. Muir had plenty to say about the phenomenon of the tea rooms in explaining Glasgow to visitors in 1901. Only Stuart Cranston and one or two others, he noted, now ran tea shops, pure and simple. Others were a hybrid with restaurants. But every kind of person comes in at one time or another. And tea rooms were credited with doing away with the daylight drinking, once common among clerks. Muir emphasised tasteful decoration as a key definer of the Glasgow tea rooms. Miss Cranston's premises obviously stood out, but all had come under her influence. He praises an atmosphere of homely excellence, tablecloths, flowers, nice china, and finds the honour system of payment simple and pleasant. Contrast the cold marble slabs of London's ABC shops where tea is set before one already mixed with milk. A Glaswegian in London is in fact terribly homesick for his tea rooms because there's nothing like them there and they're specially meant for him. In 1903, another arty hoarding went up in front of a tenement on the newly fashionable Socky Hall Street, home to several expanding department stores. It was personally decorated by Mackintosh. Kate Cranston was opening her final set of tea rooms, the Willow, designed inside and out by Mackintosh. He wrote to his German friend and Anna Mutasius, "Miss Cranston is delighted with everything I've suggested. She thinks this is going to be by far her best place." At the Willow's heart was the Salon de Luxe, like a precious jewel box. It cost an extra penny on a cup of tea. The selected waitresses were dressed by Mackintosh with chokers of big pink beads. This was all thrilling to the public, the ultimate in specialness. The Willow was indeed the culmination of the tea room as a Gesamtkunstwerk, a total work of art. Praised by the Glasgow press, it was also admiringly covered in the important German art magazine Dekorative Kunst in 1905. Thus did word spread about the Glasgow tea room. For Miss Cranston gave Glaswegians a chance to experience a complete avant-garde interior without having to live with it. And on those terms, people loved it and were proud to display it to visitors. General admiration for Kate's business capacity disposed her customers to an acceptance of this strange new design, and Miss Cranston did much to promote the Glasgow style to the middle classes. Indeed, as Margaret MacDonald Mackintosh wrote to Anna Mutasius in 1904, "The whole town is getting covered with imitations of Mackintosh tea rooms, Mackintosh shops, Mackintosh furniture, etc. It's too funny. Mm-hmm. I wonder how it will end." Well, today's Mockintosh, I guess. Miss Cranston was her own advertisement, a well-known figure on the Glasgow streets, on her daily tour of her establishments. Her prominence was effortless. Her brother, meanwhile, was an energetic, even rather frantic, an advertiser in the press, and with branded items like these. He, as you see, had modified his purist stance on catering in 1908 when he opened his fruitarian lunch and snack room. He and his wife were keen fruitarians. Food reform was quite a thing in these years. However, Cranston was still fighting on against packeted Indian and Ceylon tea, which had gained enormous market share, promoted by the big grocery firms such as Lipton's and Cooper's. In 1909, he advertised that for 40 years he had advocated mild China teas and Darjeelings as against the coarse, liquoring Indian and Ceylon teas, which latter cause indigestion from their excess of tannin. Moreover, the public who buy teas in packets, whose wrappers are included in the weight, lose one penny by short weight in tea. The story of the Glasgow tea rooms in 1909 proclaimed only Stuart Cranston's role and its global significance. What happened in Glasgow was rather tardily copied in London, other large cities following suit, and the movement spread over the length and breadth of the land and was taken up on the continent and spread to every civilized spot on earth. But it was Kate who entered Who's Who in Glasgow that year, one of only seven women out of 461 entries. And there followed the Bailey's coveted Men You Know slot in 1911, rarely accessed by a woman. "Her name is a household word," said the magazine. She saw the possibilities of the tea room if carried out on fresh and original lines, and straightway struck on a new path along which have trooped in due course a host of followers, not in Glasgow only, but throughout the kingdom. Among these many followers in the 20th century were several women, including two of Miss Cranston's ex-manageresses, who each set up on their own in 1910. Miss Rombach, the rather frightening-looking woman here, who went in for very smart, slightly more Viennese design, and Miss Buick, a softer, homelier character. Both of them married but were childless, and their businesses ran on successfully for many years in family hands under their spinster names. The Men You Know accolade was prompted by Miss Cranston's visibility at the next of Glasgow's much-loved exhibitions, the Scottish National Exhibition of 1911. The Bailey aptly ascribed her success to her great shrewdness in judging as to what people want. She has created demand by the supply of just the right thing in just the right way and at just the right price. The magazine's analysis credited her as responsible for a veritable revolution in catering for our people, a revolution in which temperance, comfort, elegance, and economy are allied in fine, progressive form. You probably can't read much of this menu, but it's really quite extensive for an exhibition tea room. This has already had a couple of outings. Miss Cranston ran not one but two tea rooms at the exhibition. McIntosh certainly designed the interior of the White Cockade, and Margaret MacDonald did its menu design, while her sister Frances designed the menu for the Red Lion, the second tea room. Kate is still using Melrose's tea. And from 1908, she had her own bakery, which included a laundry and stables. She never went in for motor vehicles. Another female artist commissioned was Jessie King, also trained at the Glasgow School of Art. And note from this that Miss Cranston was encouraging the use of the tea rooms for business meetings, and also catering for business women, the new typists or typewriters, as they were called, who were suddenly much in evidence. The tea room's cheapness and excellence had depended from the start on the labour of women, waitresses and kitchen staff on their feet for very long hours, for very low wages. And tea room waitresses didn't get tips until the 1920s. There was criticism of Miss Cranston in 2018 with the discovery of her Rules for Girls from 1911, showing that they were expected to work for 13 hours a day with a 10-minute break for lunch. It was a form of exploitation that was unfortunately absolutely standard at the time. Miss Cranston was obviously very demanding, and her establishments were run with a military discipline. Working girls had hard lives. But it's clear also that there was a pride in working for the top establishments, and many preferred this companionable employment to the isolated drudgery of domestic service. And tea rooms certainly contributed to the servant problem of the period. The First World War offered many different employment opportunities for women, and wages necessarily increased. Glasgow, with its shipyards and foundries, was busy, and so were the tea rooms as tea drinking increased. But shortages of all kinds and increasing regulations, you can see here on this menu reference to the public meals order, restricting how much you could spend on a meal, and the cake and pastry order, which said you were only allowed to spend sixpence on a plain tea between certain hours. And all this was making business really difficult. In May 1916, Miss Cranston sold up her Buchanan Street premises. Perhaps the mortgage was becoming onerous. They became a servicemen's club and later a bank. But she compensated by finding another job for McIntosh, who was now in London. The dugout was created at the Willow in the basement of an adjacent building. Its fireplace, the design you see here, served as a memorial. This room was opened by Miss Cranston in the year 1917 during the Great European War between the Allied nations and the Central Powers. The room's innovative design, strong colours against shiny black, was a sort of precursor of Art Deco, showed Mackintosh's originality undimmed. But then in October 1917, Kate's husband suddenly died. She was completely devastated and couldn't continue, though she was, anyway, nearly 68. She sold off Argyle Street in 1918 and the Willow the following year. Only Ingram Street, which was passed to her senior manageress, Miss Drummond, ran on in the old way. After a brief post-war boom, the economy soon showed signs of distress. Typical was a strike in 1920 at Kerr's Tea Rooms. William Kerr had trained away from Glasgow and returned to buy up various existing tea rooms, bringing back sharp southern ideas from his time with Joe Lyons. The firm made good profits during the war. He pioneered Sunday and late opening, which made tea rooms effectively dry restaurants, often with function rooms. The traditional tea room had generally closed at 7. But the tea room still flourished, and the Bailey returned to a well-worn theme in 1921. Every true son of St. Mungo accepts that Glasgow leads the country in tea rooms and will continue to show the world how these things should be done. Stuart Cranston had retired in 1915 as director of Cranston's Tea Rooms Limited, but the company ran on. During the war, it had rebuilt its Renfield Street premises into a picture house with tea room, two-tier lunch room, two smoke rooms, and private rooms. Glasgow opened its 100th picture house during the war. All these places of leisure grew bigger and better. In 1922, the Book of Glasgow noted the prodigious outcropping of super tea shops, picture houses, and dancing palaces. And the Bailey asked, where are all the Glasgow tea houses and restaurants going to get their profits? The supply of food palaces, each one more palatial than the other, must soon be in excess of custom. To reflect the new fashion for Art Deco, Cranston's Renfield Street premises were colourfully redecorated in the mid-20s. The surviving interiors at Miss Cranston's Ingram Street rooms began to seem oddly old-fashioned. The tea rooms were now dominated by Glasgow's great family baking firms. The City Bakeries, run by John Urie, pioneered central baking for distribution through a chain of shops. It had 36 in 1921, 60 by the end of the 1930s, with tea rooms above or behind the larger shops. They had about 1,000 employees by the mid-1930s and did much to improve working conditions. Their flagship was the magnificent Cadoro, opened in 1921, which was the year of Stuart Cranston's death, with a banqueting hall added at the top, soon redesignated a ballroom as Glasgow became dancing mad. You can see the scale of the place and the adoption of the sleek glamour of Art Deco, which was, of course, an international, no longer a local style. James Craig and his sister Jessie took over the family bakery business and developed it hugely. A big bakery in Woodlands Road pushed out vast quantities of the cakes and biscuits for which Craig's was famed to a string of shops notable for their window dressing, many including elegant tea rooms. Craig's, in fact, claimed to have been the first to import continental pastry chefs to make French cakes, which became very popular. In the company's showpiece tea rooms, the Gordon and the Rule, James's first-rate collection of Scottish Glasgow boys' paintings was displayed, maintaining the tea room's connection with local art. After James's early death in 1933, it was Jessie, the unseen hand behind the firm's success, a worthy successor to Miss Cranston, but without her taste for publicity, who steered it on through depression and another war. So Glasgow's tea rooms were still noticed by outsiders as a distinct feature of the city's social life and streetscape, distinguished by a high standard of decoration and furnishings. And the astonishing consumption of sweet stuff in the city was also noted. The super cinemas and dance halls all had tea rooms, as did the department stores, which were still doing well in the 1930s despite the Depression. Daly's was the smartest, not a high tea place. They took over the adjacent Willow Building, where we are, in 1927, and the Salon de Luxe became their bridal department. The 1930s saw new openings of smaller establishments too. Wendy's, Jean's, Rosalind's, now on friendly first name terms with their customers, often introducing a more cottagey, even rather twee style associated with English tea rooms. The segregation of sexes, of course, had broken down by now, and advertisements emphasise couples eating together. Miss Buick's was an older establishment, was still going strong. She, in fact, ran on till the 1960s. Glasgow's Empire Exhibition of 1938 was a final fling. Cranston's is still advertising its teas, and notably still focusing on its pure China teas, pure Darjeeling. And the guidebook from which these advertisements come kindly filled in visitors about high tea, warning that in many establishments, tea is a fairly substantial meal, might be regarded as the equivalent of a dinner elsewhere. The Second World War gave a final boost to Glasgow's failing heavy industries. The city was busy, though the implication of this cartoon, where a poor Scots fusilier is trying to order a cup of tea from an overstretched waitress, is that standards declined. Afterwards came sad endings. By the mid-1950s, countless social and economic changes had undermined the viability of the old tea rooms. Overheads above all, the lifting of the taboo on alcohol, the lapse of men's coffee out of the office habit, middle-class women now labouring as housewives. There was a general admiration for the new and disregard of the old. Coffee became more popular than tea. Tablecloths gave way to formica. The local bakeries were hoovered up by conglomerates. Foreign exoticism was the preferred style for eating places. The Greek Cypriot Rheostachis came to town. He bought up some tea rooms and turned them into steakhouses or licensed and decorated in contemporary style, which was, of course, external to Glasgow. Like Miss Cranston, he succeeded by giving people what they wanted. He too could claim to have revolutionised Scottish catering. At the closing of Cranston's premises in Queen Street in 1954, there was a slight awareness of their significance. We've often heard the claim made that this was the original tea room from which all other tea rooms in the country have derived. Certainly, it was always a pleasant reminder that this was one of Great Britain's many institutions which have had their beginnings in Victorian Glasgow, wrote the Journal of the Chamber of Commerce. Cranston's went into liquidation in 1955. Miss Cranston's Ingram Street premises were bought by the corporation under pressure in 1950, but not looked after. In 1971, the building was, ironically enough, sold to Stuckey's, but not before, thankfully, a few knowledgeable people were able to dismantle and store the battered remains of the interiors. But in the mid-1970s came the first signs of a turning of the tide, a feeling that destruction and loss had gone too far. The Mackintosh Society was founded in 1973, here, I believe. And in 1974, the Glasgow Herald began a long nostalgic correspondence about Miss Cranston's, as people recalled with warmth Glasgow's heyday and something very special. Thank you.
I find that I have a really unfortunate laugh, and I can hear my my deep resonance off to the side of the mic whenever Perilla makes a joke in that. I wonder if any of our eagle-eared listeners can hear my laugh in that. No, I think it is such a, going back to it now in my head, I'm remembering how special it was to hear her talking and showing pictures of the room that we were sitting in.
Yeah.
It was one of those moments where it's like the confluence of heritage, built environment history, material culture, food history, everything kind of met for that that day as we sat in one of Kate's tea rooms talking about the life, her life and her work and her her legacy that she left for Glasgow. Also, like, funny little personal tidbit, I didn't realise I had Perilla's books in my kitchen.
Oh, really?
I had just been gifted ones about Glasgow tea rooms, and it wasn't until after that, when I'd seen a pictures of her books, I was like, I've already got those, I've already read them. That seems to be a reoccurring theme for me, not being very observant, which is obviously a really great trait to have as a historian.
No, I totally agree with what you said there, Peter. I think such a rich talk. I was really taken by how many tea rooms there were, the sort of fact that Kate was at the start of this cultural wave that she really kind of, you know, rode, and then it continued beyond her legacy. I think what's dazzling to me is not only would the way that we think about tea and taking tea and that kind of social aspect would be different, but the actual fabric of Glasgow as a city would be different without this woman and without how she worked with Mackintosh. So yeah, really, really powerful illustration or case study almost of how integrated food is into every aspect of our lives.
Also, I think that Perilla, through Perilla's work and her talks and her books, I think she's rebranding spinster as a very desirable life, to look at the what you can achieve without pesky men getting in the way. until they can afford to keep up. No, I think that's wonderful. And actually,
No, I was just going to say, yes, supportive men only. Men who will support your endeavours and let you keep your name and not, demand that you be the angel of the house. We're done with the angel of the house now. We're here for the woman of commerce.
Exactly. All hail the spinster. This might be a really good moment as we've kind of not drawing a close to this year's symposium, because we've got lots more talks to put up and hopefully a YouTube that will be published soon with all of the different rooms from the symposium. I've got about 300 gigabytes of videos to get through on my laptop right now. It is struggling to keep up. But anyway, we'll be back next week with a brand new episode of the Scottish Food History Podcast. That's all.
Bye.
Hold on.
At the end of this episode, we'd like to say a special thank you to our keynote, Prilla Kinchin, for travelling all the way to Scotland to speak at the Scottish Food Heritage Symposium 2025. And we'd also like to thank Oliver Braid and the team at McIntosh at the Willow and the National Trust for Scotland for being our partners in this year's symposium.
This podcast was lazily hosted by Peter Gilchrist and Dr. Lindsay Middleton. The Scottish Food History Podcast is produced by Tenement Kitchen.